there, deep divers. Have you ever wondered what's truly happening when, you know, a patient is described as being in shock?
Yeah, it's a term we hear a lot.
Right. But it's medical meaning, and the urgent actions that go with it are way more complex and, frankly, pretty fascinating. Today, we're taking a deep dive into some really critical territory, shock and resuscitation.
It's absolutely vital stuff.
We've gathered some incredibly insightful material from pre-hospital emergency care guidelines, research, really laying out the science and the life-saving steps, our mission, to sort of demystify these high-stakes situations, look at the body's amazing, but sometimes failing, battle for survival.
And explore those crucial interventions that can really make a difference.
Exactly. So to kick us off, let's picture a scenario, something right from the field.
Okay.
Imagine EMTs Tess Price and Steph Bowman. They're called out for chest pain.
A common call.
Very. They find a man, maybe 50s, slumped in a chair, hand on his chest, clearly distressed. He's pale, sweating, like really sweating.
Oh.
And Tess immediately notices his pulse is weak and rapid and his breathing is labored.
Okay, those are big clues right there.
So what's going on with this patient? What do those signs tell you?
Well, what's fascinating is how fast those initial observations paint a picture of pretty severe physiological distress.
Yeah.
That combination, the paleness, the sweating, that weak, fast pulse, the labored breathing, it's a classic presentation. It immediately makes you think, shock.
Okay.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, shock isn't just, you know, a single dramatic event. It's really a state where the body's cells aren't getting enough oxygen, enough nutrients.
Which leads to
a cascade of failures, really. Our deep dive today will get into why that happens and, crucially, how responders jump in to help.
Okay, let's unpack this then. At its core, what is shock? It sounds serious, obviously, but what's the fundamental problem the body's actually facing?
Fundamentally, shock is defined as inadequate tissue perfusion. Fancy term.
Hypoperfusion, yeah.
Exactly. Hypoperfusion. It just means the cells aren't getting enough oxygen and glucose to do their job, to meet their metabolic needs.
And just as important.
And critically, they can't get rid of the waste products effectively either. It's a two-way street failure.
So what happens then when the cells are starved like that?
Well, it forces a major shift. Our research explains that cells normally use aerobic metabolism that's efficient, uses oxygen.
Right.
But without enough oxygen, they're forced into anaerobic metabolism, much less efficient. Think of it like trying to run a marathon on fumes.
Doesn't work well.
Not at all. It dramatically cuts energy production and leads to this harmful buildup of waste, like lactic acid. Eventually, the cell's basic machinery, like the sodium-potassium pump, just fails from lack of energy.
Leading to cell death.
Leading to cell death, and if it's widespread, organ failure.
Wow. So it's way more than just low blood pressure. It's a cellular catastrophe unfolding.
That's a good way to put it, a cellular catastrophe.
And the treatment then, logically, is all about restoring that perfusion, getting oxygen and glucose back to those desperate cells.
Precisely. That's the number one goal.
Okay, so how does this breakdown happen? What causes that poor tissue perfusion? I've heard them called the three pillars of shock.
That's a great framework. The three pillars. Think of them as the primary ways the system can fail.
Okay, pillar number one.
First, inadequate volume. This is probably the most straightforward one. There just isn't enough blood or fluid circulating in the system.
Like bleeding out.
Bleeding is the classic example, yeah. Hemorrhagic shock. But it's not just bleeding. Think severe vomiting, diarrhea, major burns where plasma leaks out.
Or even excessive urination, like in some diabetic emergencies.
Exactly. Anything that drastically reduces the fluid volume, this lowers the amount of blood returning to the heart that's preload.
Less blood in, less blood out.
Right. Less freeload means lower stroke volume, the amount pumped per beat, and that drops your overall cardiac output. When cardiac output falls,
blood pressure drops.
Blood pressure drops, and tissues don't get perfused. Simple mechanics, really, but devastating consequences.
Okay, so inadequate volume, pillar two.
Pillar two is inadequate pump function. Here, the problem is the heart itself. It's just not pumping effectively.
So a heart attack.
A heart attack is a prime example, yeah.
Yeah.
If enough heart muscle is damaged, it can't pump well. Heart failure is another cause.
Are there other things besides muscle damage?
Oh, definitely. Mechanical obstructions can do it too. Think of fluid building up around the heart, squeezing it, that's pericardial tamponade.
Right.
Or a collapsed lung putting pressure on the heart, a tension pneumothorax. Both physically stop the heart from filling or pumping properly.
And you mentioned something critical here about fluids.
Yes. This is crucial. With pump failure, cardiogenic shock, giving lots of IV fluids, which seems like the first thing you do, can actually make things worse.
Because the pump can't handle the extra volume.
Exactly. It's already failing. You're just overloading it further. It's a key distinction in treatment.
Okay, that's huge. So volume, pump. What's the third pillar?
The third pillar is inadequate vessel tone. This is about the blood vessels themselves. They lose their ability to constrict to maintain pressure.
How does that work?
Well, think about blood pressure. It's basically cardiac output times systemic vascular resistance, or SVR. That resistance comes from the vessels constricting appropriately.
Like tightening a hose to increase pressure.
Good analogy. But if the vessels lose that tone, if they dilate massively all over the body, that's vasodilation, then the SVR plummets.
And even if the pump and volume are okay.
Exactly. Even with good volume and a working pump, if the pipes are suddenly way too wide, the pressure just drops through the floor. Tissues don't get perfused.
What causes that massive vasodilation?
Several things. A spinal cord injury can knock out the sympathetic nervous system signals that normally maintain vessel tone. That's neurogenic shock.
Okay.
Or chemicals released in the body can do it. Think severe allergic reactions, anaphylaxis, or overwhelming infections, sepsis. These release substances that make vessels leaky and wide open.
Wow. That formula, BP equals CO times SVR, really ties it all together.
It does. It shows how a failure in any one part, volume, pump, or vessels can bring the whole system down.
So just to recap for you listening, inadequate volume, inadequate pump, or inadequate vessel tone. These are the three core problems behind all shock states.
That's the foundation, yes.
Now, digging a bit deeper, the sources list specific types of shock based on these pillars. Can you walk us through the common ones?
Certainly. These types really illustrate those principles in action.
Okay.
We've already touched on hypovolemic shock, low volume. Caused by hemorrhage, yes, but also non-hemorrhagic causes like burns, severe dehydration.
Got it. Volume loss.
Then there's distributive shock. This is where that inadequate vessel tone, the vasodilation, is the main problem.
The leaky wide pipes.
Exactly. Examples include anaphylactic shock, the severe allergic reaction.
Mm.
Chemicals cause massive vasodilation and capillary permeability, meaning fluid leaks out.
Okay.
Septic shock from widespread infection does something similar. Bacteria and toxins trigger vasodilation and leakiness. And neurogenic shock, which we mentioned, the spinal cord injury, causing loss of sympathetic tone. Vessels just relax.
Makes sense. What else?
Cardiogenic shock. This is the pump failure pillar. The heart itself can't pump effectively. Often happens after a big heart attack, maybe losing 40% or more of the left ventricle's pumping ability.
So the pump is broken.
Essentially, yes.
And finally.
Obstructive shock. This is different. It's not volume, pump muscle, or tone directly, but a physical blockage preventing blood flow.
Like the examples you gave earlier.
Exactly. A pulmonary embolism, a clot in the lungs blocking blood flow. Pinch pneumothorax, the elapsed lungs squishing the heart. Pericardial tamponade fluid squeezing the heart.
And the treatment is unique here.
Absolutely. For obstructive shock, the primary treatment is to relieve the obstruction. Drain the fluid, decompress the chest, break up the clot if possible. Addressing the root cause is key.
That's a really helpful breakdown. It sounds like the body is just facing this massive internal crisis, and these are all the different ways it can manifest.
That's a good way to think about it. A crisis of perfusion.
Okay, here's where it gets, well, really fascinating for me. The body doesn't just give up, right?
Not at all. It fights back. Hard.
Our sources detail these incredible, sometimes really dramatic ways the body tries to compensate for shock. How does it try to save itself?
The body throws everything it has at restoring perfusion. It activates powerful compensatory mechanisms, mainly through the sympathetic nervous system, the fight or flight system, and releasing a flood of hormones.
And these mechanisms cause the signs we see?
Absolutely. Many of the classic signs of shock are actually signs of the body compensating.
Like what? What happens first?
Well, direct nerve stimulation is almost immediate. Your heart rate increases. The heart contracts more forcefully, and blood vessels constrict widely, especially in less vital areas like the skin and gut.
Shunting blood to the important bits.
Exactly. Shunting blood to the brain, heart, kidneys. This nerve stimulation also tells the adrenal glands, release the big guns, epinephrine and norepinephrine, adrenaline and noradrenaline.
And then those hormones provide a more sustained response.
Precisely. Nerve signals are fast. Hormones last longer. Epinephrine, adrenaline has broad effects. It causes vasoconstriction, increases heart rate, increases contractility, boosts everything.
And norepinephrine.
Norepinephrine is primarily about vasoconstriction, tightening those pipes. But other hormones jump in too. ADH, or vasopressin, helps retain water. Angiotensin II is another powerful vasoconstrictor and stimulates aldosterone release.
Which also helps retain salt and water.
Yes, and glucagon helps raise blood sugar for energy. It's a whole hormonal cocktail aimed at survival.
And this explains the classic signs.
It really does, that epinephrine effect. Alpha-1 stimulation constricts iris muscles, dilated pupils, constricts blood vessels in the skin, pale, cool skin, stimulates sweat glands, clammy skin, narrows the pulse pressure,
okay.
The beta-1 stimulation, increase heart rate, tachycardia, increase force of contraction, that pounding heart feeling some patients report early on.
And the other hormones?
They lead to decreased urine output as the body holds on to fluid and increased blood glucose levels. It's all the body fighting desperately.
That paints such a vivid picture. It's literally the body screaming for help through these signs. But this fight isn't always winnable, is it? The sources talk about stages of shock.
No, it's not always winnable. And yes, understanding the progression through stages is critical for knowing how urgent things are.
What's the first stage?
First is compensatory shock. Here, the body's mechanisms are working. They're able to maintain near normal blood pressure and keep vital organs perfused, even if it means sacrificing flow to the skin or gut.
Are there signs even then?
Yes, but they can be subtle. Maybe some anxiety, slightly pale skin, maybe a slightly faster heart rate, and often that narrowed pulse pressure we mentioned. The body is working hard, but coping. For now.
Okay. What happens if things don't improve?
Then we move into a decompensatory shock. The compensation is failing, the mechanisms are overwhelmed, the body can no longer maintain blood pressure, can't keep vital organs adequately perfused.
And the cells.
The cells are really suffering now. Anaerobic metabolism is widespread. Waste products are building up. Organ function starts to seriously decline. This is where you see more obvious signs: falling blood pressure, altered mental status, very poor peripheral perfusion.
And the final stage.
The final grim stage is multiple organ dysfunction syndrome, or MODS, sometimes called irreversible shock, although we try not to use that term pre-hospital.
Why?
Because you never truly know if it's irreversible until later. But in MODS, multiple organs, lungs, kidneys, liver, are failing due to prolonged severe lack of oxygen, toxic buildup. It's extremely difficult to reverse at this point.
What a stark progression. It really highlights why recognizing it early, even in that compensatory stage, is so crucial. You can't just rely on one thing like blood pressure.
Absolutely not. Blood pressure can be normal, even slightly elevated early on due to compensation. You have to look at the whole picture. Anxiety, skin signs, pale, cool, clammy, delayed capillary refill, weak peripheral pulses, urine output.
Mm-hmm.
It's a constellation of findings.
Right. It's that holistic assessment. And let's circle back to our case study, Tess and Steph's patient. Remember, confused, breathing hard, crackles in the lungs, heart rate 116, BP 1007, 202, sat 92%.
Mm-hmm.
Based on what we've just discussed, where would you place him? Is he in shock?
Looking at those signs together, the confusion, the rapid heart rate, the somewhat low blood pressure for his likely baseline, the low oxygen saturation, and those crackles suggesting fluid in the lungs.
Yeah.
He's almost certainly in shock and likely tipping into the decompensatory stage. The crackles strongly suggest fluid backing up from the heart, pointing towards cardiogenic shock pump failure.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, when shock gets really severe or other things happen, we can face the absolute worst case scenario. Cardiac arrest.
The ultimate medical emergency, yes.
What defines cardiac arrest?
It's when the ventricles of the heart aren't contracting effectively or at all.
Yeah.
Cardiac output ceases, you can't feel any pulses, blood flow stops.
And the clock is ticking immediately.
Immediately. Our sources state brain cells start dying within just 4 to 6 minutes without oxygen. 4 to 6 minutes.
That's terrifyingly fast. And the guidelines break down cardiac arrest itself into phases, don't they? Highlighting that urgency.
Yes. These phases are really key to understanding why we do what we do in resuscitation.
What's the first phase?
The electrical phase. This is the first 4 minutes or so. During this time, the heart muscle still has a bit of residual oxygen and glucose. It's often electrically unstable, maybe in ventricular fibrillation, but it's potentially responsive to a defibrillation shock.
The golden window.
Absolutely. Early defibrillation is most likely to work here.
And after 4 minutes?
Yeah. We enter the circulatory phase. This lasts from about 4 to 10 minutes. Now, the heart's oxygen is gone. Cells are switching to that inefficient anaerobic metabolism. They're starving.
So shocking might not work as well.
It's less likely to work without help. This is where high-quality CPR becomes absolutely critical. You need compressions to manually pump some oxygen and glucose back to that heart muscle to sort of prime the pump and make it more receptive to a shock.
Okay, CPR first, then shock in this phase, ideally.
Well, CPR, while getting the defibrillator ready and immediately after a shock. But yes, the CPR is vital to make the shock effective during this phase.
And after 10 minutes?
That's the metabolic phase. By now, the heart muscle is ischemic, it's acidic from waste buildup, cells are starting to die. The chances of successful resuscitation drop significantly. It's not impossible, but much, much harder.
That timeline is just sobering. Every single second counts. So what's the overall strategy then? The big picture for trying to save someone in cardiac arrest?
It's all laid out in the chain of survival developed by the American Heart Association. It's a sequence of critical actions.
And it's slightly different for kids.
It is, yes. Yeah. For adults, the chain starts with recognizing the arrest and activating the emergency response system, calling 911 or your local equivalent.
Step one.
Then immediate high-quality CPR, followed quickly by rapid defibrillation. Then advanced resuscitation by EMS and hospital teams, post-cardiac arrest care to stabilize the patient if they get a pulse back, and finally, recovery, including rehabilitation.
Okay. And for kids?
For pediatric patients, the chain actually starts with prevention, because most pediatric arrests are secondary to breathing problems or shock. Preventing those is the first link.
That makes sense.
After prevention, it's similar. Activation of emergency response, high-quality CPR with pediatric modifications, advanced resuscitation, post-cardiac arrest care, and recovery. That prevention link is the key difference up front.
Got it. So in that chain, CPR and defibrillation are right near the start for adults. Why is defibrillation so time-sensitive?
Because the most common initial rhythm in adult sudden cardiac arrest is ventricular fibrillation, or VFib. The heart's just electrically chaotic, quivering.
Not pumping.
Not pumping at all.
Yeah.
And the single most effective treatment for VFib is an electrical shock defibrillation. But as we saw with the phases, the heart becomes less responsive to that shock over time. The VFib can deteriorate into a systole flatline from which resuscitation is much harder.
So you need to shock it quickly while it's still in VFib.
Exactly. Get the AED on and shock delivered as soon as humanly possible.
And it's not just about the shock, right? The quality of CPR matters immensely. What does high-quality CPR actually mean?
The guidelines are really specific. Push hard and push fast.
How hard and how fast?
For adults, compressions need to be at a rate of 100 to 120 per minute. That's pretty quick. And the depth needs to be at least 2 inches, but not more than about 2.4 inches.
Okay.
You also need to allow for full chest recoil between compressions so the heart can refill. And minimize interruptions. Every time you stop compressions, blood flow to the brain stops.
What about breathing?
For a single rescuer on an adult, it's a 30-to-2 ratio. 30 compressions, then 2 breaths. And critically, avoid excessive ventilation. Too much air, too forceful, can actually be harmful.
So focus on those compressions.
Yeah.
Minimize pauses.
Absolutely. Keep that blood moving.
This brings us to the AED, the automated external defibrillator. We see these everywhere now, airports, malls. What makes them so revolutionary?
They've been a game changer because they allow minimally trained bystanders and first responders like police or firefighters to deliver that life-saving early defibrillation before paramedics arrive.
They're simpler than the manual ones paramedics use.
Much simpler. Manual defibrillators require the operator to interpret the rhythm and decide whether to shock. AEDs analyze the rhythm automatically and advise whether a shock is needed. They guide the user with voice prompts.
So they take the guesswork out.
Largely, yes. They're designed to be safe and effective, making early defibrillation much more accessible.
Speaking of safety, what are the key precautions when using an AED? You're dealing with electricity, after all.
Safety is paramount, the number one rule. Clear the patient before pressing the shock button. Announce clearly, clear, and visually check that no one is touching the patient or the stretcher.
Okay. Anything else?
Don't use it in standing water, or if the patient is soaking wet, move them, dry the chest quickly. Be cautious on metal surfaces. Remove any medication patches from the chest where the pads need to go.
What about chest hair?
Excessive chest hair can interfere with pad contact, so it might need to be quickly shaved or removed with sticky tape if it prevents good adhesion. And again, nobody touches the patient during rhythm analysis or shock delivery. Movement can mess up the analysis, and electricity can travel.
Got it. Now, what about specific situations? Are there different considerations for kids or patients with pacemakers?
Yes, definitely. These are important nuances.
Like for children.
For pediatric patients, you ideally want to use pediatric pads and an AED with a dose attenuator, which reduces the shock energy, especially for kids under 8 or weighing less than 55 pounds. If you only have adult pads, you can use them, making sure they don't touch each other.
And for infants?
Manual defibrillation is preferred for infants under 1 year if available. If using an AED, use pediatric pads attenuator if possible. Compression ratios also change for kids, especially with two rescuers, often 15 compressions to two breaths instead of 30.2.
And a key point about heart rate in kids.
Yes, very important. If a child's heart rate is below 60 beats per minute and they show signs of poor perfusion, like being pale, lethargic, you start chest compressions, even if there's technically a pulse. Their cardiac output is often very rate-dependent.
Wow, okay. What about pregnant patients?
If a pregnant patient is clearly in the later stages of pregnancy, generally 20 weeks or more, or the uterus is obviously enlarged and they're in cardiac arrest, you need to do something specific during CPR.
Which is?
While they're lying flat for compressions, someone needs to manually push the uterus to the patient's left side. This is called left uterine displacement.
Why?
To take the weight of the uterus off the major blood vessels, the vena cava and aorta, allowing blood to return to the heart more effectively during compressions. Rapid transport is also key, as saving the baby might require an emergency C-section very quickly.
Okay. And patients with implanted devices, pacemakers, ICDs?
Right. You'll often see a lump under the skin, usually on the upper chest. Do not place the AED pad directly over that device. Put it at least an inch away.
What if it's an ICD, an implanted defibrillator, and it's firing?
If you see the patient twitching rhythmically, the ICD might be delivering shocks. Just wait 30 to 60 seconds for it to finish its cycle before you attach the AED pads. Don't let it deter you from using the AED if needed.
These details are literally life and death. And the sources stress what happens after a shock, right? Or if no shock is advised.
Absolutely. Whether a shock is given or not, the immediate next step is to resume high-quality chest compressions right away. Don't pause to check for a pulse unless the patient starts moving or breathing normally.
Keep CPR going.
Keep CPR going for 2 minutes, then the AED will prompt for another rhythm analysis. You continue that cycle, CPR, analysis, shock if advised, immediate CPR until help arrives or the patient shows obvious signs of life.
Okay. Let's bring it back one last time to Tess and Steph. We left them with their patient who suddenly became unresponsive, just gasping agonal breaths. Steph checked and found no carotid pulse.
Clear cardiac arrest.
What do the protocols tell us they absolutely must do right then?
Immediately. Steph starts high-quality chest compressions. Push hard, push fast. Tess manages the airway, gets ready to ventilate. As soon as the engine crew arrives with the AED, pads go on.
Compressions continue.
Compressions continue with minimal interruption while the pads are placed. They do the 30.2 ratio. The AED analyzes. Let's say it advises a shock.
Okay.
Steph calls clear, delivers the shock, and then
immediately back on the chub.
Immediately resume compressions for two full minutes. Then the AED reanalyzes. The goal is to maximize perfusion and hopefully achieve ROSC, return of spontaneous circulation.
Is there any sign they look for that ROSC might be happening?
Yes. One very useful indicator, especially if they have advanced airway monitoring, is end-tidal carbon dioxide, or NTCO2. A sudden, significant jump in the NTCO2 level often happens right before or as a pulse returns, because blood is suddenly circulating CO2 back to the lungs effectively.
And in their case study, that's exactly what happened. After the shock and 2 minutes of CPR,
they found a pulse.
They found a weak radial pulse, ROSC. Tess kept ventilating. Steph updated the hospital. It's just a perfect, powerful example of that chain of survival working.
It really is. When all those links come together quickly, it makes a huge difference.
So this whole deep dive, it really shows that shock isn't simple. It's this complex, dangerous cascade happening at the cellular level, often starting subtly.
Exactly. And resuscitation isn't just random actions. It's a precise, incredibly time-sensitive sequence of interventions.
Understanding the why behind it, all that shift to anaerobic metabolism, the role of hormones, why early CPR and defibrillation matter so much, it really drives home the urgency.
It does. Understanding that cellular crisis helps you appreciate why every second counts and why that structured approach to the chain of survival gives the patient the absolute best chance.
So what does this all mean for you listening? Hopefully you'll never be in Tess and Steph's situation or need these interventions yourself.
We certainly hope not.
But just knowing the incredible physiological battle that's happening inside the body during shock or cardiac arrest and understanding the power of immediate correct action, Maybe it gives you a new appreciation for emergency care.
Maybe prompts some thought.
Yeah, maybe leaves you with a provocative question to ponder. If you were a bystander witnessing someone collapse in sudden cardiac arrest, what would you feel your greatest responsibility is in that moment? Is it just calling for help? Is it starting compressions even if you're unsure? Is it finding that NTD on the wall? What's the most crucial first step you could take?
Something definitely worth thinking about.
That's all for this deep dive. Until next time, keep digging, keep learning, and stay well informed.